But beyond that, what happened was that because Indians were left out of the Constitution, the courts then evolved a whole concept of dealing with Indian tribes as groups. And here's where I would at least qualify what I understood you to say, and that is that whereas the Constitution was built around the idea of individual rights, as far as the development of a body of jurisprudence is concerned, it evolved that the courts dealt with Indian tribes as groups. I came across this recently doing research on the question of the Equal Protection Clause of the Federal Constitution. The Equal Protection Clause generally provides that Congress cannot pass a law that treats one group differently than the other, than another group, based upon race or religion or ethnic origin. You cannot, for example, say that whites can do something that blacks can't do, or that blacks can do something that whites can't do, or Chicanos or whatever. You can, though, and Congress has, in Title 25 of the U.S. Code, has hundreds, I guess thousands of pages of the United States Code that deals with Indians. And the question really didn't come up until the 1960s in some important U.S. Supreme Court cases about the constitutionality of that kind of legislation. Can you legislate about Indians? Well, the court resolved that by first recognizing that there are thousands of pages on the books that deal with Indians, so it must be constitutional. You have to figure out some way to rationalize this. The answer was that, which I might add is the way courts frequently decide cases. They viscerally decide how to decide them and then figure out the legal paraphernalia. But the answer given by the court was that we were dealing not with Indians as a race, but with Indian tribes as political entities. And that's the key to the proposition that Congress, that the Supreme Court, through 150 years of cases, has decided that Indian tribes are indeed political entities, that Congress has the power to deal with those political entities, and that legislation identifying those entities or people who are participants in them is a legitimate exercise of congressional power. So that in this body of jurisprudence, there has been a recognition of the right and the power to deal with Indians as groups. It's always intrigued me why that is not true, for example, with blacks. You look at the trust responsibility. There is a national, federal trust responsibility toward Indians. There is no trust responsibility toward blacks, Chicanos, Swedes, Germans, whatever. It's only with regard to Indians. And there are some interesting reasons for that, much too involved to go into sort of philosophically here, but one of the major reasons, with regard to others than blacks, you can say they came here sort of voluntarily and they chose to submit themselves to the Bill of Rights and the U.S. Constitution. That's not true of the blacks. They were taken away from the land that they owned and brought here forcibly and placed in a situation very different than Indians. With Indians, the non-Indian community came here, the whites essentially came here and took the Indian land. And it was essentially arising out of that taking Indian land that caused the creation of a trust relationship and caused the creation of this need to deal with Indians as political entities. So there's a whole mix of things there that has caused the federal government, both the courts and Congress, to deal with Indians as groups, as political entities.
May I say a word with respect to that? I wouldn't pretend that from the little that I have seen or have hearsay account of latter-day Indian law in the courts, or in the Indian Claims Commission or whatever, that's a body of law that is satisfactory, intelligible, coherent, predictable, or anything else. I think we see the full flowering of confusion and uncertainty, embarrassment and dogma let loose. And whatever happens, happens. It's really like what the kids used to talk about in the 60s. These are more like happenings than anything else. The 14th Amendment, to which you allude, does not protect groups in its language. It says that no person shall be deprived of such and such because of race, creed, or whatever. That there may be class action cases is obvious from the fact that it must be the fattest part of all constitutional litigation. But the protection is of individuals. It's because you, as a black, or a Swede, or whatever, were deprived of the equal protection of the laws, that you may seek a remedy. There's some kind of extrapolation that goes from that. As far as what I took to be your question and the way you answered it, why weren't groups other than Indians regarded as falling under a special federal trusteeship or responsibility? Doesn't that argue, you suggest, for the special political status of Indians? I'm not sure. There was another group that had special status toward which the federal government was held itself to have a special responsibility, and that was the freedman. There was a freedman's bureau with the general understanding that people who had been raised in bondage and treated in a way so as most to unfit them to be capable of self-governance ought to be protected from all the predators who would surround them and undo them and frustrate the intention of the law. But that's a sad story all its own. But blacks were, for a short time, under special protection because it was understood that they too were especially vulnerable and needed to be cared for in some way.
Could I just add a footnote to what I said?
There may have been another point there that I missed, but I'm sorry if I haven't.
Could I just add a footnote to what I said earlier? You were talking about identifying groups. Under the Canadian Constitution, the groups are identified as the English-speaking minority in Quebec, the French-speaking minorities in the English-speaking provinces, and Aboriginal peoples. There are no group rights conferred on any other peoples. The only other rights conferred or acknowledged are individual rights in the same manner as the U.S. Bill of Rights acknowledges those rights. The other provisions are dividing up powers and all this sort of thing.
These group rights are really terribly thorny. One thinks of Amish. They have special the United States is such an immense patchwork of a whole variety of conceivable groups, and some not even conceivable, but nonetheless there. Thanks to Xeroxing cheap paper and an availability of lawyers, there will be no shortage in the foreseeable future of groups rising to claim their rights and trying to seek through litigation what they can't get through the electoral and legislative process. Now, I'm not saying that the rights of individuals ought to be contingent on their being able to form a majority. That's one of the points of the Bill of Rights, that you shouldn't mess around with people just because they're weak, just because they're few. Maybe those are the people toward whom one ought to be especially solicitous, because you're enlarged by dealing largely with people who can't help themselves effectively. That's another thing. But it's always a difficult matter when you're on the receiving end, when you're the claimant, when you're the petitioner. What one court gives, another may take away.
just Joe Jorgensen and then David Case, but just before we leave this, or at least before I leave it, there are group rights and group rights. We're all aware of the acknowledged right of old age pensioners to receive money under statute. There are class actions that may be brought on behalf of groups such as the handicapped or this and that sort of thing. But when we're talking about group rights for purposes of this discussion, it seems to me we're talking what we might call minority rights, the rights of minority peoples. And in Canada, as I say, their right to certain religious practices is enshrined, their right to public funds and facilities for the propagation from one generation to the next of their language, and as the vehicle for education is enshrined in the rights of Aboriginal peoples. Not identified, those rights aren't identified, are said to be enshrined. So that when we're talking about groups, we're talking about, it seems to me, minority peoples. That's the interest that in the largest sense is seen appropriate to be promoted and preserved. So forgive me for taking up some time, but these are fascinating questions, and they seem to me to go very much to the very foundation of what we're talking about. Well, Joe, and then David, and then Rosita.
Ralph Johnson beat me to it. I think it's a very important point about the way in which the federal government has dealt with Indian tribes and the body of law that has emerged around those dealings. My understanding in the laws of the rules of judicial construction as it relates to Indian law is that the reserved right doctrine becomes very important. That's to say that a treaty reserves to Indians all of those rights by tribe that were not taken away from them, either by treaty or subsequent legislation. Now, going back to the Northwest Ordinance of 1783, I think it's crucial that much of that language was carried over in spirit, at least, in the Cherokee cases.
And that's speaking of the ordinance?
The ordinance itself.
87.
Of 87, yes. 1787, where it points out that Indians in their life and liberty shall be protected, and they should conduct their lives as they direct it, that their property shall not be taken from them. It is theirs. That from time to time, just wars may be waged against them. But even then, their lives and property shall be protected at the conclusion of such wars and the like. That beginning with this, it's very clear that Indian tribes are recognized as something like a sovereign. That they are groups with which you deal, who own property, who have political cognizance, who will direct their own affairs, but who may be destroyed by might if in a just war. I think only theologians talk about just wars. In the Cherokee cases, what's his name, Walzer excluded. I don't think he came up with a just war, but he did talk about them too, didn't he, Michael Walzer? That throughout the body of law that's developed, Indian tribes have recognized the sovereignty they want to have. The government has responded by recognizing the sovereignty that is there. It's clearly limited, that sovereignty. And the rights that they seek are the rights of sovereigns that have not been taken away from them. Many of those have not been acted upon, and I think that was an important point in Ralph Johnson's presentation yesterday. But as the law unfolds, rights that have not been taken away are reserved, and they're now being acted upon little by little in new ways. And that the sovereignty of the 1990s may be much, much more than the sovereignty of the 1970s. I think that's the way that things are moving now. The fact that native peoples of North America relinquished their property against their will, had their population in the United States alone reduced from 2 million to 230,000, a nadir at around the turn of the century, that their resources, their land base was reduced from 2 billion acres to 32 million acres through treaties, suggests we were always dealing with these limited sovereigns, and now the limited sovereigns are acting upon rights and reserved rights that they have.
Professor Lerner, yes, go ahead.
If you say that Indians are a special case,
yeah,
under the Constitution, I have no problem with it. If you could say something like sovereignty, meaning something like sovereignty, and that emphasis appeared always in print and in speech, I might also live with that. The problem is that qualification, the highly qualified character of that, is more likely to engender false hopes than anything else. It is still the white man's court which will pass on these things. You may be right that what Indians enjoy in the way of self-governance, self-determination, will be much greater in the 1990s than it is now. But then we can talk about something that's cognizable under the laws and concepts of the Constitution. Then we're talking about another matter. We're talking about self-governance or self-determination. So even that carries a fair amount of freight with it, too. Are we talking about the self-determination of Slovenian people under the Austro-Hungarian Empire? About the linguistic rights of people under that empire? There were 7 or 8, I forget now, officially recognized languages, and there was constant litigation to extend it to yet another and yet another. Well, that's another story.
Yes.
But it shows that these problems can be approached in a variety of ways without raising a kind of expectation and a kind of boogeyman, a kind of specter that somebody referred to earlier, whether it was in conjunction with the steelhead fishermen or whatever, that simply freezes discussion, freezes thought, and narrows the heart.
Well, you may have explained a good deal to me in what you just said. It's strange. The seat you're sitting in, I wonder if it's anything to do with the position at the table. It always seems to be in the last couple of meetings, it's been the chair that has been occupied by the person who is most focused the issues, I think.
I only mindlessly followed the nameplate.
I don't think it was intentional.
Whether there is design in someone else's mind, I can't say.
It will help me to focus the issues a bit. If I, and I'm not sure if this is a good idea, but I guess you agree that there are such things as group rights in the United States.
No, I don't agree to that.
If you mean
under the law?
No, I mean in fact, and under the law, in the sense that Ralph Johnson has talked about the rights of Native Americans as political groups under the common law, the domestic common law of the United States.
I don't know what the domestic common law with respect to groups is.
No, with respect to Native Americans, it's fairly clear, I think, and maybe you don't agree then, that there's no such thing as a group with rights as a group under the law of the United States.
Let me try to put it as plainly as I can.
Please do.
I think it is to the immense advantage of Aboriginal peoples or anyone else who is vulnerable to tyrannical majoritarianism to locate his or her rights within the mainstream of the legal protection of the land, so that those who would deny those rights must, in the course of doing so, render questionable their own enjoyment of their rights.
Okay.
We have an enormously valuable heritage, and I don't think it should be discounted because it proceeds on certain ways of thinking that are utterly alien or largely alien to Indians and others.
Okay, and then is it fair to say that you would view the existence or the exercise or the assertion of group rights as a risky, bad, some sort of normal, you attach some kind of negative value to that, either for the people who assert those rights or for the nation as a whole?
All of the above.
Okay, good. Then I think that very clearly sort of sets, in my mind anyway, the question of group versus individual rights and what is the place, if any, of these rights, collective versus individual rights, within this within the American nation. And I don't purport to have an answer to that question, maybe even a position. But I think it's important to realize that is an issue.
Right.
And you seem to be very firm and fervent in your view of it as an issue.
The Indian is a human being like everyone else. And we have a law that protects human beings resident in the United States. It doesn't say no citizen shall be deprived or thus and so. It says mm-hmm. No person shall.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't see why it's a diminution of one's Indianness or one's Aleutness or Eskimo-ness
mm-hmm.
to say, yes, I'm that too. It's been said. It's been said in this room.
Mm-hmm.
I'm that too.
Right. Okay.
These are important aspects.
No, I understand what you're saying, and perhaps in the next couple of days we'll have a chance to go further into the question. I think it's an important question as to whether the rights of a group as a group are as important and protect other things, other interests that are not really protected, afforded to individuals
mm-hmm.
who happen to be members of that group. I had another point, but I mean, if you're following up on this, then maybe it'll be better to let Kim join in.
Make your point, because I think Rosita comes
okay.
Before.
The other point about just historically, I guess I would take some issue with and just put this on the table. And that is as to the origin of the policies of the United States or of the legal position of Native Americans. It seems to me, and I am, you know, it just is my view, I guess, that it is perhaps the product of well-intentioned and the best of the white leadership that is resulted in some policies that favor, as you mentioned or as you characterized, the vulnerable people. But I think it also should be remembered that these Native American people were not always so vulnerable, and that in history, the white people, when they came to the shores of this country, were the vulnerable ones. And it has always seemed to me that vulnerability of the white people was one of the reasons we developed a history of treaty making, because the white people needed the Native Americans to survive, or at least their non-opposition, so that they would be able to survive as in their isolated colonies. And later with the French and the Indian Wars between France and England, in which the Indians were the allies of both sides, their military ability, the Native American military ability, was crucial to the outcome of that war. And that's those, this history seems to me to be a history of groups of people that are behaving very much like independent nations. And to me is something of the background of the history of treaty making that brings into the consciousness of the courts and the common law in America a sense of Native Americans as having inherent political powers of self-government, and which I would characterize as sovereignty, but that seems to say too much in some senses to some folks, so but at least let it go at that, that there is an early recognition and dealing because of these military realities of the white people and the Indian people as separate political entities.
The self-governance or the right of self-governance that you speak of is not necessarily, I don't see any necessary logical dependence on the notion that you're dealing with utterly separate political entities. It's enough to know that Indians aren't simply falling right under the usual terms of the Constitution. They are something other than, say, their self-governance is other than, say, the powers of home rule of Cook County or the city of Chicago, right? Cook County and the city of Chicago are creatures of the Illinois General Assembly.
Yeah, right. Sure,
Indians, I mean, Indians' existence, their corporateness, is not something that can, notwithstanding all the bad things we heard about BIA, it simply can't just be, you know, concocted, you know, in a simply arbitrary way or done away with by a stroke of a state legislature.
No, and again,
and to that extent, you look, is there another level in which you could have self-governance
right.
that operates not at the state level, but, you know, with some kind of federal aegis?
I mean, it's just a bit simplistic, but let me just suggest that the Commerce Clause sort of lays this out in outline form with all of these prepositional phrases. I mean, there are three political levels that the Commerce mm-hmm. Clause discusses: foreign nations, Indian tribes, and states. And I think that is of some significance. John Marshall thought it was of some significance that the Indian tribes were within the Commerce Clause and that they were treated separately from both states and foreign nations,
mm-hmm.
Which implies to me that there's a separate political existence there. I would say political existence, and maybe you would take issue with that. Oh, okay, that's fine. That's all I really had to say. Thank you.
Yes, I'd just like to shift it to another, back to a point that you made when you first started talking, and that was I guess it's a problem for you in your understanding, or at least your perception of indigenous people being between, being betwixt and between, and you'll have to forgive me because I don't always understand these English sayings, but as I understand it, I'm assuming that you're thinking that that there is this movement between two points and that indigenous people are between them.
A foot in two worlds.
Okay, foot in two worlds. That's right. Okay, and you seem to have a problem with that. My understanding of social science, at least the social science that I studied, recognizes that cultural systems indeed are dynamic, that they do change, that they are not static. However, there seems to be a general assumption that this doesn't apply to Native American studies, to Native American societies. And it is a problem that has posed tremendous difficulties for Native American societies. I at one time did an exhibit at the Peabody Museum at Harvard, and I was trying to really show the dynamic change that goes on and change that could occur, but yet core values, the social organization, belief systems that could still be retained in spite of the adoption of new technology. And so I did a potlatch scene. And on one side, I had a traditional potlatch where the young man was going to assume his position to be the next chief. And they all had traditional clothing on. On the other side, I had people dressed just like myself. In fact, several of the molds were made from my face because also there seems to be a perception about what Native Americans should look like. So I did this in exhibit.
Your every man's notion of what a Native American ought to look like.
Right. Okay. Anyway, I did the potlatch scene. We were all wearing traditional clothes, all contemporary clothing. Yeah. And the same sort of things were going on in the traditional ceremony as had been going on in the one that was supposed to depict a late 1800 one. People just could not understand what was going on in that modern contemporary scene. And after I left school, it was dismantled. But it is a problem that poses a lot of problems for Native American. The adoption of new technology, such as you seem to have some problem with the Inuit girl listening to rock and roll. The adoption of new technology does not necessarily mean that these values or that social organizations, traditional social organizations, will necessarily change. And I think I can understand, you know, when we look at American society, when farmers adopted the new technology, then we saw that there was indeed changes in their social organization. The larger family, extended families began to break up, and then there were, you know, along with the Industrial Revolution, there was this movement of families all over the United States. For Indians, Native Americans, this does not necessarily apply wholesale. I mean, there are Indian values and that allow them to maintain that kind of cohesiveness, that group interaction. Just because Eskimos are now using snow machines doesn't mean that they don't go out and hunt in groups or that they don't share. So I'm saying that it is possible for new technology to be adopted. It is possible for me to sit here and speak English and still yet maintain a core value system and a social organization that is still very basically Tlingit, for in my instance, Tlingit.
May I say a word to that? Right. I thought some of the examples I gave were exactly in that point. I tried to bring out some of those instances I gave, ranging around, you know, where, you know, situations that had come to mind out of my own observation. I presented those as examples where people, with great deliberateness, with great effort, were able to maintain what they defined for themselves as critical to their, you fill in the blank-ness. Okay, you understand what I'm saying? Whatever it is, their Lithuanian-ness, you know, their Jewishness, their Bedouin-ness, that they had done that, it was possible, but it was out of an awareness of what powerful forces had to be contended with. I'm not saying that it's fated. Once you let in the first Betamax, it all goes down the tubes. I'm not saying that. But it would also be a mistake to underestimate the seductiveness, especially to the young, of a world of whose complexity they have a very imperfect picture. It looks good. And the message that comes across is that if it feels good, it can't be wrong. I don't think that's a message compatible with what most self-defining people hold to be right or necessary for their preservation. I'm not saying that it's impossible for them to do it, but that it requires the prior consideration, the hardest kind of question from my standpoint, and that's why I began with it. And a question that only you can answer for yourself. You not as a Clinkett, but you as Rosita Worrell. What does being X mean to me? I'm not saying it's, I mean, that there's a single formula. Are the Eskimos less Eskimo because they, may one use that word? Okay, because they use epoxy to append the pins to their carvings, because they have some other tools maybe, because they adapted scrimshaw techniques to the market of whalers or whatever? Are the Navajos less Navajo because their designs were affected by the demands of Fred Harvey or whatever? No, I mean that would be simplistic in the extreme. I mean, then you're not talking about a living tradition, you're talking about a museum.
The point that I was trying to make was that, I think that Native Americans have that kind of general understanding. The point that I was trying to make was the perception from the dominant society. When they look at Native Americans and they see this mixed bag, they perceive that to be somehow not legitimate. That perception carries over in some laws, some legislation, such as, you know, hunting and fishing, where the people who are making the laws insist that that they should use traditional technology. They don't want them to use rifles or things like that. It's that perception that causes problems for Native Americans.
General rule, never underestimate other people's capacity to misunderstand you. Right.
Kim Gottschalk and then Russell Jim.
I think it'd probably be better to defer to him at this time if he's going to follow up on this, because I'm on a different topic. I wanted to go back a little bit.
How far back? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will not defend myself because of my limited vocabulary and your academic life is showing to me and your ability to dissect every word and phrase, which perhaps brings you, as the term would be, as I heard you, your problem, but I don't think it's a problem. I think you're bringing out some very insightful, perhaps irregularities in regard to the understandings, misunderstandings. It is certainly enlightening to hear someone say that the Indian people are human beings, which was very questionable not too long ago. The terms nits make lice and savages, terms of this nature, which was not too long ago in the past. And your term, how can you afford to allow a group of people, and your constant reference to Lithuanians, Jews, etc. But I must refer back to my original statement when I first sat here, and I mentioned that we were put under the Office of Public Affairs under the present administration, because the Office of Public Affairs dealt with non-governmental functions of the United States. And we were quick to announce to Mr. Blackwell that you are dealing with the oldest governments on this land, but also you are dealing with the oldest culture on this land. And Americans just celebrated 200 years here not too long ago. And so, not only the oldest culture, the oldest religion, perhaps in the world, no one really knows. But I can only reflect what I have been taught that has been handed down through the ages, from hand to mouth, unwritten, no different than the songs that we sing on Sundays are unwritten, unrecorded. They are learned from mouth to ear to heart. So the point Mr. Case made also, and others, in regard to the uniqueness of these indigenous people. And so therefore, the Constitution of the United States, not directly involving the indigenous people, but implying, such as the implications in our treaty and other treaties as alike. So I had to say this, and I hope I didn't misunderstand you in any way, but the points you do bring out are somewhat valid, but I hope for the sake of this meeting and for sake of my conscience, that you will understand what I am saying also.
Kim Gottschalk?
Yes, I just wanted to try to understand a little bit better your points about individual versus group rights. I guess in my mind, to a large extent, that question's already been asked and answered in a definitive way by the Supreme Court, which identifies the rights of, however you want to call it, of self-governance or whatever, as group rights for Indians. And there's an extensive body of common law to that effect. And even within the right of self-governance, if there's a right of hunting and fishing, it's recognized that that is not an individual right belonging to each individual Indian, but rather it is an Indian right as a member of a political group. And these are doctrines that have been formed in the white man's court. I understood you to say you're going to the white man's court and using the right white man's rules, and therefore you must understand that the rights that they place value on and protect are individual and not group rights. And yet we have gone to the white man's court, and the rules that they have given as far as Indian law are concerned say that they are group rights that they're dealing with.
I repeat again, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't give legal advice without a license. I don't have a license, so I'm not giving legal advice. I just sense that when those alleged group rights, I don't know if the Supreme Court has used that term. Have they?
Well, they've said tribal rights.
Tribal rights. Your problems seem constantly to arise when tribal rights come up against other people's rights, rights asserted by individuals as individuals.
That's already happened as well, and they've come down solidly on the side of group rights. That's the Santa Clara Pueblo case that Mr. Naranjo was talking about.
The solidity of judicial judgment is a sometime thing. It has, I think that Mr. Jorgensen has and others have pointed to the weathercock character of those judgments. They point one way and they point another. And when things become hot, they cease pointing altogether and just say they can't do it. They don't know what to do with it. I'm suggesting there's a problem in this, because although the language that is often used, you see it here in this journal, it's in with these resolutions, the language is the language of demand. In fact, I mean, it's like, you know, kids in the 60s were demanding. They had non-negotiable demands, you know. But in fact, you're asking someone who has the power to give or to withhold. I'm saying there's an appeal that might be raised to what Lincoln called the higher angels of our nature, and that by creating a situation where people have to deny what they constantly are asserting is the dearest thing to them, yes, that this is a nation of rights, of individual rights, and that man ought to be safe and protected against tyrannical action from those who've got more clout and more might. Yeah? If you put people in a position where they have to deny that, then you reach them in a very different way, and not one likely to elicit the kind of response that somebody reported earlier. What did the Indians want now? Haven't we settled this already? Haven't we given them everything that they wanted yet again?
You want to
this is not a legal doctrine, and it's not even a legal strategy. I'm raising a question.
Well, from this, it's hard for me to disagree with the proposition that if you can have a right phrased in terms so that if someone took away your right, their own right would be threatened. I can't argue with the fact that that would be a nice strategy. Whether it fits in, I guess, is the question I'm raising.
One other point on this. Some people believe that the decision of the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka rested in some way on some social science evidence that was footnoted somewhere. Well, it doesn't really, but in any event, I mean, it doesn't within the terms of that opinion. But what a terrible risk that entails for blacks, to the extent that people believe that their enjoyment of non-segregated schools, non-discriminatory schools, rests on some social science research based on the reactions of white children and black children to white dolls and black dolls. We're not talking about social psychology. We're talking about the most fundamental thing a human being could have. What's the basis for it? What if we have new social science coming out of some college, maybe better conducted than the one that was summarized in that footnote?